Hello, everybody. I hope that you're having a great day today. My name is Victoria. I'm a student and a member of the GSE IT team. Today, we're going to take a journey online together. So much has been happening recently in Stanford's remote classes, so our goal is to share, celebrate, and reflect on what we've learned in remote education during the past fall quarter. Today, we have Ann Jaquith and Ann Porteous, and they're going to chat together to build those insights collectively. Ann Jaquith has taught remotely in the spring, and Ann Porteous just finished teaching this fall. So, therefore, Ann Jaquith thought it would be helpful for her to ask some questions to Ann Porteous about what she's learned throughout the past quarter, and specifically how she implemented her course this fall. Before Ann and Ann get started with their conversation, I thought they could do a brief introduction of who they are and where they fit into the Graduate School of Education. So, Ann and Ann, do you mind really quickly just explaining what course you either currently teach or have taught during remote learning, as well as kind of like what's your broader role in the School of Education?
I'm Ann Jaquith, and last spring, I taught a class called Leading Change in Schools for the first time. And this winter quarter, I will be teaching the Introduction to Qualitative Methods. And it will be my first time teaching it online, but it will be my third time teaching the class. And when I'm not teaching in the Graduate School of Education, I am leading a center on campus, SCOPE, the Stanford Center for Opportunity Policy and Education, where I mostly conduct research and manage projects.
I'm Ann Porteous. I'm a senior lecturer at the Graduate School of Education. I have been in this role for the past 20 years, which is a little surprising to me even. I have been teaching for all those years a course on data analysis, Introduction to Data Analysis and Interpretation, focused on graduate master's degree students who will be more consumers of research rather than doers of research, although many will go on to do research themselves. So it's a conceptual course in statistics, as it turns out, not focusing on a bunch of formulas. I also teach a course on designing good surveys in the winter quarter. This fall was the first time I had done any teaching online. So unlike Anne, I didn't have the benefit of the spring, but I had the benefit of everybody who did teach in the spring to figure out how to do this online this past fall. I used to teach a course in evaluation. I no longer teach that course. I also run a small grant program with money from the School of Education that I award to doctoral students to support their dissertation research.
And I have been looking forward to having this conversation with you for the last several weeks. So I'm excited that we can do this. One of the questions that I wanted to ask you is, I know from having talked with a student of yours, that your classes tended to be about an hour and a half this past quarter. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. And so I know that you rearranged things, because I know that that's not the usual length of your classes, if I'm correct. And so I'm wondering how you approached the planning for moving content out of the in-person synchronous learning.
Great. Well, let me need to give you a little bit of a background, because I started with kind of a leg up, so to speak. I've been teaching this course in Introduction to Data Analysis and Interpretation. I've been teaching this course for 20 years. And about 4 years ago, I moved the content, all the substance of the course, to an online format. And I did that because we had our colleague, Candace Till, had come to Stanford from Carnegie Mellon, and she had been developing online statistics courses there, and I was pretty interested in what she was doing. So I said, I've taught long enough. I want to do something new. I'm going to put this course online. So that is where I started, even from this year. It's been online for 4 years. That's just the content part. We were using the class as an application time. So with the idea that students will have come to class, they will have gone through the content. In that content, which we call learning modules for now, we have embedded assessments. So as they arrived to class, we knew what they knew and we knew what they didn't know. And so we could target our class time to helping them get to those concepts that they may have not fully understood when they were just reading the material online. That then, once we went to this online idea, that enabled us to actually take the course, which used to be 2 hours in length twice a week, and pare it down to an hour and 20 minutes. And actually, we teach two sections of this class. I teach the other person who teaches with me is Sonny Smith, who you know. And we had originally thought, because she had taught in the spring, that and she had learned that students' attention span is pretty darn short, that we should get the class time down to an hour. So we started off with that as our goal. And we quickly discovered halfway through the summer that we couldn't do it in an hour without, if we wanted to build community as part of our class. And I had learned from all of you that building community was such an important part of what we need to do with this online environment. I've been doing that in class, and I know you had been doing that in person anyway, but it takes more focus to figure out how to do it in the online environment. So we re-upped the class to an hour and 20 minutes, and that's kind of where we stood. We had materials, class materials. I've had them from the past, and Sonny and I would go through each week, or we were ahead of the game, and we'd have to just say, what are we not going to teach here? And what can we give up? And what is really critical to keeping as class time? So because our class is focused on application of the concepts, we knew that we didn't need to have all these little side lectures that we had in the past. So we could just eliminate all those. And anything that was in a side lecture, I went back and made sure that we incorporated into the online learning modules so that we didn't have to worry about that. So that's kind of the background to this course.
Yeah, so that's actually really helpful. And even though we've talked about this, you're teaching over the time, I learned quite a bit from what you just said. I'm wondering, can you give an example of what was like a side lecture and how that got incorporated into the asynchronous learning that they were doing?
I think it wasn't so much of incorporating new material into the online materials as much as just not repeating so much of what were in those materials. I had lectured for, 16 years. So I think I had a little trouble giving up some of my lecture notes. And so as a result, we had the learning materials online, but then I would sort of bring them back, some of my prior lecture notes, because I didn't want to give them up. And I think what mostly it was about is just saying, I don't need to do that. I don't need to give them the summary tables of different statistical procedures. It's already in those learning modules. So it would have been that kind of thing that I could strip out of the notes. Every now and then, I would come up with some new graphical way of showing a concept. And actually, to be honest, Sonny and I have talked about this. I'm going to go back now in the coming months. And I'm going to put all those newfangled ideas I came up with, I'm going to go back and incorporate them into the learning modules. Because even with an hour and 20 minutes, we rarely went through the materials that we had planned. The other thing I did was we would always come to class. You know how teachers are. We're afraid that we're not going to have enough material and that we're going to get to the end 15 minutes early and have nothing more to say. Well, so I had loaded through the years my materials with practice problems. And these were pieces of research, and we'd bring them up and say, okay, here's a table, look at it, tell us what's going on. So we had many of those in the background always in case we ran out of time, in case we had extra time. We never had extra time. We put all of those into after-class practice. So our Canvas site was set up as each week it had before class, which was stuff they had to do, during class, which were our any kind of PowerPoint slides or materials we had for working in class, and then after class. And after class is where we put these practice materials. So we just, it was just a matter of systematically trying to strip down the course materials that I had been using for all these years. Hard to let go of things, though, that you're in love with.
Yeah, no, that's, it's interesting what you said. I think that's true. And I think that although, you know, in teaching my class last spring, although I hadn't taught it for 16 years, in fact, it was really the first time I was teaching that course, it was still like intellectually challenging to decide how to pare down to the very essence of what was most critical, because I just didn't feel like I had the luxury of additional time that I would have in an in-person setting. And I can see how it's a different side of the same problem if you have 16 years of material that you've been doing, right?
Yeah. And as I say, I had half of it online already.
Right.
So for me, it was a matter of saying, okay, how am I, so I could have the luxury of just focusing on class time. What are we going to do in class? And what I learned from you all from last spring was the importance of engaging the students, keeping them active, not having them sit in front of a Zoom screen for too long, changing things around some, so they're not just sitting. So for me, that became more of my challenge, is to really how to structure that in some way that kept the course moving. I think putting people into breakout rooms was not the easiest thing to do. I had to learn how to do it, right?
Well, I'm curious, of the things that you experimented with this past fall to keep students actively engaged in the class itself, what did you discover that seemed to work pretty well?
So I did, well, first of all, I always think it's how you introduce a class, and you know that better than anybody else. I mean, you really have to get the trust of the students, and you have to, first of all, know you care, and you really care in this kind of an environment, because I had a student from Zimbabwe who had terrible internet connection the whole quarter. I had one from Brazil. I had one in Mexico. So I knew that they weren't meeting each other. You know, they weren't getting to know each other except through all these Zoom experiences too. So that was definitely something I knew I had to spend time with up front. And that's what I knew was going to take time out of the actual class content time. We used breakout rooms liberally. We were lucky. My class only had 12 students. That was a complete luxury to me. And usually it has 30. So I lucked out in many ways, which it turns out I had a really good experience this quarter. I'm eager to see the student evaluations. But I was able then to use two TAs with a class of 12 students, and we were able to have a facilitator in every breakout room, unless we put them into pairs rather than groups of three or four. And I think that was really critical. The other thing we sort of struck on more towards the end, and I think this actually idea came from you or at one of our workshops, is We structured the breakout rooms very specifically as to what the students needed to be doing. So they couldn't just go into breakout rooms and chit-chat. I mean, that was fine if they did a little chit-chatting. We wanted them to do that. But we had specific tasks. We gave them a specific time. And we had them put their work out on Google Slides or Google Docs. So we actually sometimes were in those breakout rooms and sometimes we weren't. We just let them on their own, but we could follow their work and what they were doing to get that work done. And they knew that they could call one of us to come in to help them if they were stuck on something. So they had to be engaged in order to make that work. And I would go out and look at these their activities on Google, and I could see they were all contributing. That was what was the great part, because we can see who's typing, right, when they're typing something into a document. So that became a really important method for us to use to keep them engaged. And then we'd bring them back and have some reporting, and then we'd send them back again to do another part of the task. So we were trying to keep them moving. And again, I think one of your ideas, one of the workshop ideas was when they go into breakout rooms, pretend they're really moving to a different room. So get up and move around, right? And actually do something with your body while you're moving to this other room. So that was sort of what we hit upon as a way of keeping them engaged without them sitting there and being lectured to. And it gives those who aren't just jumping in to speak, who are a little quieter, it gives them the chance to take a role. Like I would notice that some of the students who were not very vocal in class, they were the ones who took over, who were sort of in charge of setting up the slides out there for the task. So everybody seemed to take on different roles that was suitable for their personalities.
That's interesting. And did you, and how large did you have your breakouts? Was it like groups of three or?
Never any more than four. Mm-hmm. Usually groups of three.
Yeah.
And then sometimes pairs. I mean, you can't get to every pair, but sometimes pairs, because I think it's good for them to just do one-on-ones with each other.
Yeah. I found that too. That the one-on-one sort of lent itself to, you couldn't be the silent partner, right?
Yeah.
You can be quiet in a trio.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I think the TAs are critical in these courses. I feel like the School of Education has been incredibly generous with all of us. You know, they gave us a digital assistant if we wanted one to help us get going and get things coordinated. And we've always been well supported with TAs in statistics courses because there does need to be a lot of support. So when it turns out that we had so few master students coming this year, they never suggested that we drop a TA. They wanted to fully support TAs this quarter.
Yeah. I wonder, I have a couple questions that I want to ask you, but just to follow up on your comment about TAs, what was it that your TAs did that you found were so critical or that would have been very difficult for you to have managed your class of 12 online this year without having the TAs?
They took charge of doing the breakout rooms each time. I didn't do random breakout rooms, but I also didn't leave students in breakout rooms together for more than a week at a time. So they kind of managed that flow and they would group them. They answered a lot of the chat questions. I was not following the chat questions. So to me, they were critical in that respect. And that allowed students to be asking questions on chat and then people to be asking students, you know, live. They kept reminding me to record, or they would push the record button that I would forget to do. And especially after go into breakout rooms, the record has to be restarted again, right? So there were definitely mechanical things like that. They played a role in terms of explaining content. They read and helped me grade papers.
Sure, sure. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. Well, one of the things I wanted to ask you is, you spoke about having students that were located all around the globe and knowing that the students weren't getting to know one another other than in these virtual classes. I'm wondering how you approached the community building and creating a sense of belonging in the classroom at the very opening, like the first day of class, and then how you thought about continuing to nurture that sense of belonging and peer-to-peer relationships as well as peer-to-instructor relationships over the course of the quarter.
So I think I used every single one of your good suggestions from the panels we had in the spring. Usually when I go into class, I'm pretty loose, you know. I kind of like to have fun with students, and I start that way. Well, it's not quite as easy to do that, and you have to be careful because they really need to get to know you before they understand different people's sense of humor. So right. I had to be careful with that. We did a lot of rename. We used the renaming function a ton, especially in the very, you know, for the first 7 weeks. And each class we had a different rename that we asked them to do. Now, you can't go through and ask everybody to then tell us about their rename. But so I'd say first name and then one of your favorite books, or first name, a piece of music that you love. I mean, it wasn't even necessarily related to content. Now, I know in the spring you said, another good way of doing that would be have something that is related to the content of the course. We never quite went there. We just sort of stayed on this fun level. Uh-huh. You know, we did that sort of rename, pickups, go into your room, pick up something and hold it up to us. And then we do three or four people reporting about what they were holding up. So
that idea came from Michael Hines, if I recall.
Oh, yeah. Did it? Okay. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, I like that idea too.
Yeah.
I think your idea was more about do it something that's related to the course to get them engaged. We just didn't go that route, but could have. We just didn't. We stopped the renaming more towards the end. Just sort of feeling like they'd gone through how many weeks of this quarter and everybody was doing renaming in their courses and that was sick of it. So my concern has been, we know what we're doing in our individual classes and we can vary that, but we don't know what everybody's doing in the other classes. So even though we think we're varying things, in fact, we're just repeating what other people are doing too. So I worry about it getting monotonous for students. And I don't know how we can deal with that.
I'm worried about that too. I'm worried about that too. And I'm also wondering about groups of students that may have built connection over the fall quarter in their classes, coming into a virtual environment where some will know each other and some won't know each other at all. And so I'm trying to wrap my brain around how do we develop a sense of community and belonging for this particular class, which in an online environment where some students will know each other and others won't, and they will have had an experience of different ways of getting to know each other from other classes. And so, yeah, not wanting to have it be sort of redundant.
Some of it is how you group students too. I really tried to make sure I didn't put students from the same program together as much as I could avoid it. But that depends on class size. And of course, we had such small cohorts this year that, you know, you couldn't avoid doing that. But I think that's right. I think that's a big concern going into winter quarter. The concern going into fall quarter is nobody knew each other and we needed to sort of figure out how to get them connected. Now going into winter quarter, like you're saying, we've got people who know each other and then people who don't.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, One last thing that I wanted to see if you had any tips for or something that worked particularly well. I know that you had the students doing their learning modules before they came into each class. And so you had a pretty good sense of what students understood about that particular content. Were there any other ways that you collected information about what students knew how to do and understood, or provided feedback to the students along the way in the course that was different this year because it was online?
I can't think of anything that was different. Mm-hmm. We have sort of formative assessments built into the course materials, into the learning modules, so we could check that way. We do a separate formative assessment after we get through a topic area on t-test to make sure that they can do that. But I've always done that. We ask for feedback after every written assignment. There are 3 paper projects during the quarter, and we ask for feedback around that after each of those, so we get some sense. We use Poll Everywhere a lot. Mm-hmm. So often at the end of class, we'd have a question about, how would you describe your understanding of the materials we've covered in class, and would put it up as a word cloud. So we're trying to check in absolutely every class is all along the way. Now, sometimes I'll say things like great or getting there or slowly getting there. And I won't necessarily know who's saying that, but we continually reach out to them in all of our weekly announcements to say, if you need some help, be sure to contact us. We're just a moment away. And none of that feels like it's very different from what I've done in the past.
Right. It does sound like that when you were asking for feedback or checking in, you also did it in a variety of ways. So, I mean, one of the themes that I hear running through everything that you said is paying attention to a variation of engagement, right? So that things didn't get tired, right? Which is, one of the things that it strikes me as we're sitting here, even having this conversation over Zoom, we all go to our same, or at least for me, I go to my same space in my house and I log into my computer, and that's where I do all of my work all day. And I think for the students, it's the same way, right? So it feels like there's a greater need to try to create more variation to accompany the routine. than we've had to do in the past when students are coming into, a particular classroom space.
Well, and even the students who are on campus who are in small spaces, you say, get up and do something between breakout rooms, and they have nowhere to go. You say, they're sort of caught in their space. Where are they going to go? I just say, stand up and do a jumping jack or something. And honestly, I learned all of this from you guys who taught in the spring, and it was helpful to have Sane had also taught. So she was able to take her, what she calls her failures. I don't call them failures at all, but her glitches along the way, and to build them into what I was doing. So I felt like I had the advantage of so much support around me that it was kind of hard to completely fail. I don't think I completely failed, but all these different ideas, like I just learned in that teaching symposium run by the university about Jamboard, I guess that's what it's called. Well, that looks kind of like a cool tool. I'm a little though worried about introducing too many technology tricks and different tools to students. I think that I'm getting some feedback that from other people that says you want to pick 2 or 3 maybe and just live with those through the course. Don't try to be fancy too much of the time. I don't know. How do you feel about that?
Yeah. I mean, what that's making me think of is it's not about the tool. It's about the use of the tool, right? Mm-hmm. And so as I'm thinking about this course that I'm going to put online for the first time, I'm trying to think about what are the couple of tools that will best serve the content. So I always really used the whiteboards in the classroom that I taught in. They became a feature of the way I approached the course.
Yeah.
And actually having students gather at the whiteboard and think on the whiteboard and circle around the room and talk about what was on the whiteboard.
Yeah.
So I think I am going to use Jamboard in my class, not because it's Jamboard, because it's a way to actually simulate the whiteboard kind of interaction, which is the way I conceptualize the pedagogy of the course. And yes, I agree, having too many of those kinds of things, you end up thinking too much about the technology and not really about what the technology is trying to enable you to be able to do with the students.
Yeah, that the I just looked at Jamboard for a little bit and it looked a little bit limited to me, but something like Jamboard or whiteboard or whatever. Yeah, I mean, because I use the annotate a lot and I think that students actually thought that that was pretty useful to them. Because you could type in.
Oh, can you tell me how you used annotate?
Well, sure. I use it like you use your whiteboard, like I always use the whiteboard. You know, I'd get students to come up and draw out what they were talking about on the board, right? Mm-hmm. And you can do that with annotate. You just, you know, throw up a screen. And I would build in a blank slide actually to my if we're going through a set of PowerPoint slides, and they can go annotate. You know, they can type, they can draw, they can, there are shapes that they can put in, they can put in hearts and stars and whatever right. It is. So I it's sort of accomplished the same thing.
Yeah.
You could have groups contributing to a picture. I mean, this is a little detail, but I have them draw a picture of hypothesis testing, right? And so they could all contribute.
That's nice. And then it's, you can save it, right? So then you can.
Yeah, you can save it. I never actually did, but you can save it.
Interesting.
But you have to clear it for the next slide. Otherwise the annotation stays up if you're moving through PowerPoint slides.
Right. Okay. The little tricks. Well, and those were the questions that I had wanted to ask you about to help me think about how I want to design the qualitative methods class for next quarter. And this conversation was really helpful.
Well, I've got a similar challenge because I teach survey design next quarter too, and I've never done that online. So I'm interested in what I say and what you say, because I've got the same issue to try to figure out how to do that. And that's very interactive because it's a lot of peer feedback to each other about questions that they're developing. And I'm desperately trying to think of a way to make that not monotonous over time. I would just say to all of us trying to do this, that one thing I learned is the importance of really being clear as to what we wanted the students to be doing and how we wanted the students to be engaging. I think I've been a little loosey-goosey about that in the past, because when you're in person, you can maybe control things a little bit more. What about you, Anne? What are some things that you came away with from your experience?
From my experience last spring was such a challenging time in this country, and things were changing week to week, if you all recall. I think, so I frame that context because I'm not sure how much what I learned was a product of the particular context in which I was teaching, or if it was about being online. But I learned that it was really important for me to have a pretty deep understanding of what each student wanted to learn and wanted to be getting out of the course, and also have a clear sense of what I wanted and thought was important for the student, you know, to offer the students in terms of content. But never have I taught when I felt so strongly that I needed to understand what the students' interests and needs were. And when they didn't necessarily match what mine were, how do we make an adjustment so that they could be getting out of the experience what they felt they needed and wanted? So that was my learning from the spring.
Funny that it takes online learning for us to learn all these things about how to be successful teachers. Yeah. Maybe education will change going forward.
Maybe. Well, thanks a lot for talking.
This was fun.
Looking forward now to taking sort of some of these ideas that we discussed and weaving them into my thinking about crafting winter quarter.
So let's keep in touch about what we're each doing so that we can benefit from each other's learnings.
Yeah, I would love that. Thanks.
Thanks.